This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. We're culminating the Fall Member Fest this week, and your donation this hour is matched dollar for dollar from the Membership Challenge Fund, a group of generous donors who've given right before the Fall Member Fest began, and we would like to hear from you. Of course, you can go to WRKF.org anytime, but if you're so inclined and want to do it the old school way, 855-893-WRKF, 855-893-9753, and you'll be in and out in fewer than 89.3 seconds. And later in the hour, we'll hear from the founder of the radio station, the man who started making plans in the late 70s for what we know today in 2022 is one of the top entities in this community, Eric DeWeese. We start with two major people on the political scene, one of whom has been with us back when he was working with Fox, Major Garrett. He's now the CBS chief Washington correspondent. And David Becker, one of the leading elections experts in this country, is joining us. They have collaborated for a book called The Big Truth. David is the executive director and founder of the Nonpartisan Center for Election Innovation and Research. In The Big Truth, the subtitle is Upholding Democracy in the Age of the Big Lie. And good morning, gentlemen. Nice to visit with both of you.
Jim, good morning. It's Major.
Major, it's been a few years, but you have been around the block. And back in the day, in the early O's, we never anticipated where we are now with an election that was decided in the overall vote by more than 7 million votes. And really was not close in the Electoral College. It was the same margin that Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton by. And yet many people have latched on to this theme that it was an illegitimate election. And that's what your book is about and the repercussions moving forward. It really is an interesting time, and it's going to be fascinating, both good and bad, I would presume, about where we go from here.
It's a really good point, Jim, and the reason David and I wrote this book, and I want to make it clear, I could not have put the book together the way we did without David's assistance. David has lived this life in election law. He worked at the Justice Department. He has spent 20 years either working on the fine granular details of election laws at the Justice Department or subsequently working with election officials around the country. And the reason we put the book together is to tell our fellow Americans that you don't have to be happy with the election. It is your right as an American to be displeased with an election outcome. What we urge Americans not to do is transfer that dissatisfaction into a myth that somehow this dissatisfying result came about because your fellow Americans, because that's what you mean if you say a stolen election, your fellow Americans conspired to deprive you of something that you were entitled to, meaning your candidate winning. And no conspiracy happened. No group of Americans got together and stole this election. Americans participated in record numbers, the most diverse electorate in our history. We came up with lots of adaptations to have what is a complicated process, voting, done in the teeth of a global pandemic without vaccines and with only minimally understood and minimally applied social distancing and mitigation strategies. It was, at its core, Jim, an American success story. I'm not talking about the result. I'm just talking about this thing that we did on behalf of our democracy, putting an election together, very few rules of the road in a pandemic, record turnout, most diverse electorate ever. All those things are fundamentally good American traits, things that you do in moments of stress and where adaptation, cooperation, and collaboration are required. We did all of those things. And at that level, we should be pleased with ourselves, not alleging a crime that never happened in the first place.
Yet today in the New York Times, there are photos of the 139 members of the U.S. House who voted to overturn the election. And in that mix, by the way, four members of the Louisiana delegation, Steve Scalise, Garrett Graves, Clay Higgins, Mike Johnson. These are people who have benefited from questioning the election. The New York Times said they have profited politically from their vote and are expected to fill the Republican leadership posts in the House. So, David, you have logged a career looking at elections and in the hopes that we can make them better. But in this case, when reality goes out the window, it makes your job hard to do, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, you raised such a good point there, Jim. There were 130-some members of the United States House who were all on the very same ballot that the presidential race was on. The very same pieces of paper in most cases. And we had more paper ballots in the United States than ever before. Verifiable paper ballots is actually something Louisiana is moving towards. But they were on those same pieces of paper. Their authority to question an election derived from the very same ballots they questioned. Try to wrap your mind around that for a second. And that was true not just for members of Congress. That's true for people in the state legislatures all over the country. They were on the very same ballots. Are they arguing that they were not legitimately elected and we should not be listening to them at all? Of course not. And they shouldn't be. They were elected. We had more paper ballots than ever before, 95%, including all of the ballots in all of the battleground states. We've never had that before. That's way more than 2016, when it was about 75 to 80%. We had more audits of those ballots. And those audits, what they do is those are hand reviews of the ballots to confirm that the machines worked properly. We know the machines worked properly, not because we trusted them, but because we double-checked and confirmed looking at the ballots themselves. We had a full statewide recount in several states, including Georgia, for instance, where they did the entire recount by hand. In fact, former President Trump could have asked for a full statewide recount in the states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. That was his right under the law. Jill Stein did it in 2016. He did not choose to do that. We had more judicial scrutiny of the rules of the election than ever before, more cases brought. Everybody knew the rules on election night because they had been resolved by the courts more so than ever before. In fact, Republicans won nearly 90% of those cases. And then we, of course, had more judicial scrutiny of the result than ever before, over 60 courts all over the country, including Trump-appointed judges. And to this day as we sit here, is 700 days past the 2020 election, and there has still not been a shred of evidence, not a single piece of evidence provided to any court or law enforcement that would indicate that the outcome was wrong. Not one piece. Now, they'll put stuff out on social media, but they won't bring it to courts because they know it won't stand up.
The book is The Big Truth, Upholding Democracy in the Age of the Big Lie. Big Lie in all caps, The Big Lie. Now, Major Garrett and David Becker, two people from different walks of life, but both of whom have logged a career, their careers, covering elections. And you make the case that our democracy is being challenged more severely than at any time since the Civil War. Major, is this hyperbole or is it real?
No, it's real. It's very real, Jim. And I wish, I will tell you a phrase that David and I have embraced. I thought of it, but we both believe it's true. This is a book that David and I had to write. We just wish we didn't have to write it. And what I mean by that is I'd wish our country wasn't in this place. Our elections, Jim, right now, nationally, and remember, elections are conducted not as a national federalized event. They are deeply localized. They're the most local, one of the most localized things we do as a nation. We decentralize control over our elections. That's why you go to local precincts and you see your neighbors there. Our elections and the procedures behind them and the methods to double and triple check them and to secure them are better than they've ever been. Better than they've ever been. Better than they were in the 60s and the 70s, the 80s, when I was a young man watching election returns with my parents because I was a news junkie as a child. They're better than they've ever been. And yet we're at this place where we doubt them more than ever before. It is a dichotomy that doesn't need to exist and is sort of a feverish expression of a lack of confidence in our own country. And that has many sources, Jim, many sources. And I'm not trying to talk people out of either frustration or dissatisfaction with either their state or federal government. All I'm asking them to do is take a sober look at how we actually do elections, understand that they're reliable and credible as never before, and to David's point a moment ago, authority is conferred by elections. If we get to a point, and this is why we wrote that our democracy is in peril, where we no longer believe elections,
then we can't believe the authority granted by elections. And if we don't believe the authority granted by elections, we're not compelled to follow the rule of law. And if rule of law breaks down because our belief in our democracy breaks down, then there's only one path ahead of us, anarchy. That's not a country we want to live in. And more importantly, it's not a country we have to live in at all.
A heavy topic, and one that is certainly pertinent. 1 month and 5 days away from the midterms, we will have another segment with Major Garrett and David Becker, the authors of The Big Truth About the 2020 Election, as noted, won by more than 7 million overall votes by Joseph Biden, who received more than 300 electoral votes. As we look back over the last generation, there have been other elections for president far closer than this one. And yet Donald Trump has 139 members of the House on his team saying the election was illegitimate. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, another segment with Major Garrett and David Becker, two of the foremost authorities on American politics, and they have collaborated for The Big Truth About the 2020 election and the repercussions moving forward. And there is a midterm election on November the 8th, 1 month and 5 days away. So if you're doing the math, 1 month and 5 days means that we're getting real close, as in 28 days left in this month and then 8 days next month. So it'll be 5 weeks from tomorrow. How do you see what happened in 2020 being applicable to what occurs a month from now, David?
Well, I think one of the things we saw in 2020 was, for the first time in American history, and you alluded to this, we've had close elections in the past. We've had sitting vice presidents who were the losing presidential candidates preside over their own electoral college defeat, as Vice President Nixon did in 1961 and Vice President Gore did in 2001, close elections decided by one state, which was not the case in 2020. But the difference here is that we have had years now of attacks on the process, delegitimization of the process, using just blatant lies, as to continue to keep the sincerely disappointed supporters of the former president, who the majority of whom are not insurrectionists. They just wanted the other guy to win, and that's normal in elections, but they have been subjected to a constant onslaught of lies seeking to keep them angry and, most importantly, donating to the grift, which unfortunately they have been doing. And we've seen elected leaders and candidates embrace the big lie, tell people that elections are stolen unless their candidate wins. This is a very dangerous place to be in, and it's a genie that you can't put back in the bottle. It is, we are seeing already, as we saw in 2016, as we saw in 2020, candidates seed the ground with these toxic lies that they have to win or else the election was stolen. And then if we see people losing these elections, and that very well may be the case, and it might not be all that close in some cases, it might be close in other cases, that instability in the period of time immediately after the election could be ripe for political violence. This is something that concerns Major and I a great deal, is that once you get to the point that you cannot process the idea that in a 50-50 country, your candidate might lose, where are we as a society? And if you think that that can be contained just within one political party, you're likely kidding yourself. Because if this just becomes another political tactic to claim that elections are stolen, what happens when you have to adopt that tactic just to remain on the same playing field?
Well, and as noted, four members of our delegation, Scalise, Graves, Johnson, and Higgins, they voted to negate the election. All of these are erudite people elected by the citizens of Louisiana. And they're fully aware that as Republicans that it's dangerous to challenge Donald Trump. Major, how many of these lawmakers, House members in particular, and a few senators, do you think they really believe this, or are they just doing it because they're concerned about the repercussions with the former president if they don't back him up?
Well, they're concerned about the repercussions with the former president, but they're also concerned about the repercussions for their grassroots supporters. And this is a very important part of this story. Because former President Trump unique among all American presidents who preceded him, began to sow the doubts about this election in the summer of 2020. He memorably said, "The only way I lose is if the election is rigged." He began to sow those doubts, and so Trump supporters were right to believe his completely fallacious statement the morning after the election, "I won this election. It's already being stolen from me," or something to that effect. And then, of course, there were all these confusing tweets about count the votes, don't count the votes, depending on the jurisdiction, when the process is to count all the votes, and the votes were counted and the tabulations were real and believable and verified. But the conversation I've had with so many Republicans goes like this, Jim. "My people believe it, therefore I must too." Okay, it's not acceptable for them to counter-argue with their own base of supporters on this question. So they have to find ways to say that the election was somehow illegitimate, but they don't want to try to plunge so deeply into the conspiracy theories or the allegations that do not stand up to any scrutiny at all. They typically fall back on, "Well, that state changed its rules, and I think that was a rule change that was outside of the legislative control, therefore it was not constitutionally sound, therefore I have questions, or there were irregularities." And there's this sort of slippery, stunted language that they use to associate themselves with doubts about the election without actually feeling the need or being pressed to explain exactly how. Irregularities has become this sort of umbrella terminology to cover people who know as a fact the election wasn't stolen and there wasn't fraud sufficient to overturn the outcome. But irregularities and doubts allow them to occupy this safe political space because they associate themselves with it and they don't get any flack from their grassroots supporters. And what David and I argue is that's all tactical dancing on the heads of pins about something you ought not to dance around. The election was legit. You lost it fair and square. And here's what you do when that happens. You concentrate on winning the next election. That's how democracy in this country is sustained and perpetuates.
The book is the big truth.
And that's where
truth.
I think this ought to go.
Upholding democracy in the age of the big lie. Now, Donald Trump, he said similar things in 2016 on the eve of the election with Hillary Clinton. I think he thought he was going to lose, but he won. And of course, he didn't challenge an election. He won, but he is the only president other than John Quincy Adams to lose the overall vote for president twice. And he looks like he's running again in 2024. How do you see that election, which, as we know, as we ramp up for it, we're about a year away from the campaign beginning in earnest. What do you think, David, about Trump potentially being on the ballot in 2 years?
Well, I Major and I try not to make predictions too much in this book. I mean, we talk about possible paths, particularly some things that we're very concerned about. But I think what we can say for sure right now is that whether we can debate whether Donald Trump was the cause or a symptom of this election denial disease that we're seeing, it is probably irrelevant at this point, because if Donald Trump went away tomorrow, it's still here. It's still something we're going to need to deal with. We're seeing this from candidates in all kinds of states, not just states that were closely won by either Biden or Trump, some states that were landslide victories for either of the candidates. We've seen sitting very effective secretaries of state, Republican secretaries of state, in states like Indiana and South Dakota, be removed from running for re-election, lose the nomination at their conventions because the party activists have sought to, I guess, punish them for presiding over elections, which, by the way, former President Trump won in those two states in 2020 and in 2016. So I think at this point, whether Donald Trump decides to run or not, we still have a very, very precarious situation in which we're living. And the 2022 election, which, as you pointed out, is 36 days away. And the immediate aftermath of that, where ballots are being counted. And we should recognize that, by the way, in 2022, on election night, that there's a very good chance that we will know literally nothing on election night. We will probably not know the outcome of many individual races that are too close to call. and we will almost certainly not know the outcome of whether which party controls either the U.S. Senate or the United States House of Representatives, all of which are being all of which elections are being held in new districts. So we have to be very careful about setting expectations, because that period of uncertainty is going to be a ripe for election deniers, especially if they're behind, and some of them will be, to incite political violence. It's going to be really hard to assess what we're looking at in 2024 without knowing what happens in 2022. We're still waiting to see if the Electoral Count Act revisions that Congress has considered and which are important are going to pass prior to the next Congress. So I think, I guess the short answer is, ask us early next year, because I think there's still a lot to play out in the course of this year.
Well, from two of the best in the business is The Big Truth. David Becker, by the way, in addition to his election knowledge, he was a two-time winner of Jeopardy and a winner on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And Major Garrett's been doing this for a while and with great success in many places, Fox, CBS, and The Beat goes on. Thank you, gentlemen. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number for us is 877-217-5757. And a reminder that we'd like to hear from you for the WRKF Fall Member Fest, 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753, or wrkf.org. And there is a member match. Our staff at WRKF is calling this Monday Morning Monster Mash in honor of the holiday, the Halloween, that's in the offing later in the month. Your match, or your dollar, your donation is matched dollar for dollar from the Membership Challenge Fund. This is a group of donors who gave before the Fall Member Fest. Again, 855-893-9753. And it's pertinent at this time that we have in studio Eric DeWeese, the founder of WRKF. Without him, there might be a public radio station here, but it would have taken a lot longer. He was the person who did the hard work, the elbow grease that was necessary to give us what we have, and it started with a very humble beginning, shall we say. This is the equivalent of a log cabin birth, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It was. We started life out on Frenchtown Road, where Planchet and Frenchtown go together. And those of you who know that part of the Baton Rouge, that's also a place where it floods quite often. And there were more than a few times when we had to make a very circuitous route or to even take a boat one time to get to the studio. Very humble beginnings, but it's really paid off.
And the RKF stands for Richard Kilburn Foundation. Who the heck is Richard Kilburn?
Richard Kilburn family is up in Clinton. Richard Kilburn Sr. was a district attorney up there for a long time, and Richard Kilburn Jr. is an attorney up there. We had a devil of a time getting our 497-foot tower built. Originally, we wanted to put our transmitting antenna on an existing tower, but we were brand new. We did not have any credit rating. We had no credit at all. We had, I think we had about 64 members when we signed on, and 12 of those said the check's in the mail. So we could not prove to any tower owner that we could pay the lease fee. So we decided we had to build a 500-foot tower, and not everybody wants a 500-foot broadcast tower in their backyard with that red light flashing. And we looked at four or five different sites, and the biggest problem was the Federal Aviation Agency. They kept saying, no, that's a hazard. And Richard Kilburn popped up and said he had some land on Frenchtown Road, the family did, and if that would work, we were welcome to it. And he very generously donated 5 acres of land, and off we went.
Richard Kilburn family, that's the actual RKF. And right. Richard, of course, has been on our show. He's a talented lawyer and an economist, and he is a smart fellow. And he was there for the genesis of WRKF. And a listener asked, this is Holly in the Garden District, when did the move to Valley Creek take place?
We moved in March of 1986. And while we enjoyed the flora and fauna out on Frenchtown Road, it took it was quite an effort to get out there. On a good day from downtown, it was 45 minutes. So we were hoping to get in town as soon as possible. And Brent McCoy at what was then Louisiana National Bank said that the bank had some land on Office Park just off College Drive, and we were welcome to one of the lots. Very generously donated it to us. The building itself, we actually got a few grants, but mostly we got the money from our listeners, saved it up.
Same story. And of course, without listener support, there is no WRKF, certainly not as we know it, because everything is dependent upon listener participation, including the funding from CPB.
Exactly. CPB money, it's about 13% of the total, minority, obviously, but it's matching money. And so if WRKF doesn't raise money from our listeners, no money from CPB. And in fact, the formula they use, if the average public radio station shows, let's say, a 5% increase in membership income, WRKF has to match that to keep the grant even. If we only raise 3%, then our CPB grant goes down. So it's a incentive for all the people listening out there to call or go online. I keep saying I'm dating myself. I always say call.
Well, of course, calling is good.
Calling is good.
Phones still work.
855-893-WRKF. Or if you're inclined to do so, just go to WRKF.org. There's a nice button. You just punch that button and you're a member.
855-893-9753 for your show of support. Any contribution is welcome, no matter what you're capable of delivering. It's a matter of what you're comfortable with, and you become a member of the family. And I can tell you that when I became the station manager after 23 years of the great legacy of Eric DeWeese, I think we had about 4,000 members then, and we have about 4,000 members now. It's consistent, but of course the population has grown, and we'd like to get more of you as members of the family. One of the draws for this drive, an orange ceramic morning edition bowl, $10 a month. That's $120 a year, and you'll be able to show your support, and you will have done a good deed for the day, the month, and the year. And WRKF has survived for almost 43 years, almost 43 years. 23 years with Eric DeWeese as station manager. Then I was there for almost three, and then it was David Gordon for 10, and Cyril Vetter was interim for a year, and Paul Mawson has now been the head for about 6 years. So we haven't had that many managers, and we've had a great staff. And Eric, I know when you started this, you had no idea the community support and the talent that was available in our community. And I've noted that at one time, on All Things Considered, every week, it would seem, we would hear from either Ed Cullen or Andre Kudrescu, both of whom were coming in and out of Valley Creek.
Exactly. And Danny Heitman, who was a columnist with Advocate, would be on periodically, too. And it was great to feature local talent, and they are talented writers. And we also were able to make possible for the various people at Southern University and Louisiana State University to appear on the National Public Radio programs and get a nationwide audience, and help to enhance the reputation of those fine institutions and Baton Rouge itself.
Not many know the backstory about Eric, but he is a Vietnam veteran. I've noted a few times, we've had three presidents born in 1946, all of whom found a way to stay out of Vietnam. But Eric DeWeese, who was born the same year, he went over there with Ed Cullen.
Yes.
And you fought in that war and lived to talk about it. You're from the Midwest. How did you end up in Baton Rouge?
When I got back out of the Army, I went back home up by Chicago. And the polite way to put it, being a Vietnam vet was not cool then. And I was having a devil of time getting a job. And a friend of mine was down here in, actually in Lafayette, and said that there was a lot of people who needed grants put together. A grant in the nonprofit world is a business plan. You write a budget, goals, objectives, personnel, all that. So I came down to start writing grants for these various organizations. And one of the first things I noticed, there was no public broadcasting. And at that time, there was no public radio, no public TV. And I found there was a state agency that was working on getting a PBS station, Baton Rouge, but no one was working on getting a public radio station. So it was 1975, I started running around town saying how great it would be to have a public radio station. And I did have a lot of explaining to do, because there was no public broadcasting, no PBS, so people would say, what is that? And I would have to tell them about these wonderful programs. And the truth is, a lot of times people would say, well, that sounds like a great idea, but you're really going to do that in Baton Rouge? Really? And I would say, yes, we could do it. And actually, one of the things I took out of that is Baton Rouge is capable of doing more than it thinks it can. And of course, we did get the station on the air, and it's been well supported. But as the late Lou Carter said, it's like a car. The tank runs empty, and you got to put more gas, or in our case, put more membership dollars in it to keep things going. So we appreciate everyone who has pledged. And all those people who sign up for the sustaining, you just sign up once, and the money goes to the station, the amount that you designate, and you can stop anytime you want. So,
well, Eric built a powerhouse in this community, and at one time, WRKF was the highest-rated public radio station in America. Used to have the Arbitron ratings on the wall, number one in the country per capita, which is basically how ratings work. But it has been continuously a high-rated station. For example, when I look at the Baton Rouge ratings, and I get them in my capacity at the Louisiana Radio Network, this hour of programming for the last several books has been fourth in the market. So we thank you for your support. And Baton Rouge is a community in which the two urban stations, WQXY and the Max, I'm not even sure they're call letters, they get about one-third of the audience by themselves, and then everybody else is fighting for the rest. But we are fourth overall because of you. So we have a lot of people in this community who treasure public radio. And Eric, who moved to Los Angeles in 2003, when we come back, we'll talk with him. I was surprised in visiting with him the other day. He notes some comparisons between the Los Angeles market and the Baton Rouge market, even though Los Angeles is number two and we're about 75. But nonetheless, there are some comparisons. And Eric had success at KUSC, the place that coaxed him into coming west. And he is still living there in Pasadena. And we're privileged to have him with us again. If you'd like to participate, we would like to hear from you, 855-893-9753 or WRKF.org. And we're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Only a couple times a year do we come before you to seek your support for a continued period, and this is one of them. And we, of course, need your support, or we wouldn't be asking for it. And we also know that in that 4,000 members or so, some people contribute more than once per year, and we thank you. But we really want to thank the people who come aboard and become new members. And as I stated, I don't care how much it is, you join the family, you're a stockholder, and when I was station manager, when people would call the station, I immediately would look at the member list, and some of them, of course, would say they were members, and then I would see they weren't, but the ones who were, then I took note, because they had actually some stock in the station, and they wanted us to do well, and corrective criticism or praise, whatever, it's always nice. Again, 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753, and you just heard from Eric DeWeese, who's with us again for our final segment, the founder of WRKF. Came this way from the Midwest, went to Millikan College. His roommate was a broadcast legend named Gil Gross. Talk about a voice and a great news presence. And I suspect the two of you talked a bit about radio back in the day.
Oh, we did. We did mock interviews, and we had there was a little small town near where we went to college, and we had a mythical radio station there that we programmed.
When you say mock interviews.
Well, we interviewed each other, and nobody heard it but us. I'll take it back. We did record a few. my alma mater had a station on the air in the 1930s. It got squeezed off. And one thing Gil and I did, we worked to get a college station on the air at Milligan University, Decatur. One did get on the air, I think, 3 years after we graduated. The administration was always very judicious on how it and careful. So things never moved too fast there. But in a way, it was a good trial run for working on getting WRKF on the air. And I like to say that I had the honor of making the first contribution. I rented a post office box at the Audubon station on Government Street and in the name of public radio, because at the time had no idea what the call letters would be, did not even know what the corporate name would be. And it was box 66142. I got
there. You go. Yeah, there, I heard you telling Paul that the other day.
Mind full of trivia. And from that point, we went on, and many people then contributed. So I like to think there are many founders of WRKF, people who had a chance to offer some assistance. And it became a true community station, community project.
It is a village, and no doubt it has had many people who've come and gone. And 1980 was 43 years ago. I was in college. It was that long ago. And I remember listening back in the day. But when I became station manager, I became acquainted with some of these voices I had heard through the years. One of them was Lou Carter. Of course, he died a few years ago. He would have been 100 next year. We'll have to have a celebration for Lou Carter. But yes. I think of Don Moore and Bob Mooberry. What a voice he had and what a presence on the air. Connie Navratil, Lewis Miller, Elizabeth Griffith. I could go down the list of the people who were with us then and were big parts of my 3 years in your chair, and they're no longer with us, and we have to replace them.
Right, and we are fortunate. We have a whole new generation at WRKF, and they're doing a fine job. And of course, Jim is one of the new generation, and we do appreciate the work they do. They need your support. If the listener doesn't support the station, I don't know who will. So we do need you to go to WRKF.org, make the pledge, or that number 855-893-WRKF.
And I do want to note one of the mainstays almost from day one and appropriately honored at the Founders Luncheon, Taylor Caffrey.
Yes.
And a big talent who's done this pro bono. He's a lawyer, so that's his pro bono work. He's done it since 81, so that's right. More than four decades.
Yes, Taylor was one of those fine people that just found their way out to Frenchtown Road when we were in that Quonset hut out there, and offered to help any way possible. And he has a fine presence on air and real interest in folk and Americana music, and started then and keeps going.
Mm-hmm. Taylor Caffrey is to WRKF what Nick Spitzer is to WWNO. And before Paul became station manager, they actually took Nick off his hometown station, but he's back and he does great work. And you hear them both on Saturdays. We've got time for a call or two. Robin Dow, our producer, says, and a reminder, the signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Steve and Jefferson, good morning.
Hey, Jim, how you doing? Shout out to Eric. And my parents were originally from Decatur, Illinois, where I lived before I got to Baton Rouge. I'm a sustaining member. I remember my mom calling Eric when she found out that he was also a graduate of Milliken University. Keep up the good work.
Yes. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you. And in case our listeners don't know, Decatur, Illinois is the soybean capital of the world.
I remember, yeah, some good athletes have come out of Decatur, Illinois, and it is it's part of the breadbasket of America, right there in the heart of the country, and you had no idea you were going to end up in Baton Rouge. And then in 2003, you get a call from Los Angeles based on his exceptional work in Baton Rouge. Eric was known nationally, and he moved to market number two, and, you know, it's a little hard to turn that down. And it is a fine station and a great university, KUSC, but you weren't located on campus, right downtown. You could see the Hollywood sign from your office.
I could.
It doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No, that was that was one of the finest offices anybody could have, it, as far as the view went. And I always joked I could do my own smog check by looking for that Hollywood sign. If I saw all the letters, air was clear. So, but it was a great opportunity, and I still live in Los Angeles. Actually, Chris and I live near the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. But one reason I got a chance to go out there is because WRKF was doing so well. We were generating more listener hours per dollar spent than any station in the NPR system, with very little money in comparison to some of the stations in the system. With not much money, we were generating a lot of listening. And that's a real credit to the Baton Rouge community.
And I mentioned, you noted that Los Angeles, as far as population, much bigger population, about 15 million people in the metro area, but still, you think of it as a place with enlightened people, and they have many of those, and you don't have to be educated to be enlightened, but like Baton Rouge, fewer than 20% of the people in Los Angeles have a college degree.
That's correct. Of course, it helps when you have like 12 or 14 million. We're not really sure how many people live in Los Angeles, but you look at the census data, and it's about 19% for both communities. And it's a credit to those 19% that they punch above their weight and they support public broadcasting, radio, TV, both here in Baton Rouge and, of course, out in Los Angeles. And I should quickly add, I've had a chance to visit with Beth Courtney. And I always think of our friends of public TV at WLPB as another organization that punches above its weight. I mean, Louisiana's not the most populous state. Yeah. We're not the richest state. But the quality of the programming produced by WRKF and LPB, it brings credit to the community and gets distribution nationwide.
And Beth used to be the face of CPB. She would be on shows like Crossfire representing
right.
public broadcasting when Newt Gingrich was taking it on. Another one of those legends, born in the 1940s, 1940 to be precise, and we'll talk about it more tomorrow, but Raymond Strother, the notable and exceptional and legendary political consultant, died a few days ago, October 1st. He was 81, and he had spent many hours with us, and we will miss him. And his impact on Louisiana politics is immense. But many people have come through Louisiana, and we may very well be the center of the universe and that there always seems to be a Louisiana angle. But when you were at RKF, a listener notes, you got Garrison Keillor, who was the biggest star in the galaxy on public radio. He came here how many times?
When I was here, he came here twice and did Prairie Home Companion from the Centerplex. And I remember the first time he came, he was on the cover of Time magazine. And of course, that's when magazines were distributed paper. And I remember going into the airport and you would see the newsstand and there was pictures of Garrison Keillor all over the place. And he was broadcasting from Baton Rouge that week. It was great to have him down here.
Well, and he was a big star. Unfortunately, his career ended with a whimper, but he left a huge impact on programming. And I mentioned some of those people who have come and gone, and a listener wanted us to expound. We only have a few seconds, but Bob Mooberry.
Bob was a great voice, a great presence on air, and a whole lot of fun to work with.
He was a character. We need more people like Bob Mooberry. He made life fun, didn't he?
He did.
I remember when he got married in 2006, he said, Jim, this is number 6 in 06. And it stuck. He was with Renee until he took his last breath. And Malcolm Robinson told a touching story about talking to Bob on the phone as he was dying. And he was an exceptional talent.
He
knew it. He knew it.
Yes, he did. And it really was sad because it was in the midst of COVID. And well, so he only
Eric
talked by
gotta
phone.
Got to run. But thank you so much. Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow for Robin Dow. I'm Jim Inkster. Stay tuned.